She's a MacArthur Fellow, Dr. Billie Jean Young. She is a performer of a one-woman play entitled Fannie Lou Hamer, This Little Light. Thank you for joining me today on Like It Is.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We're going to play a little bit, let the music play just a little while longer as we talk. Tell me about the play, the one-woman play that you have carried literally from one end of the country to the other end of the country and beyond. Tell us a little bit about how you developed that particular program.
Fannie Lou Hamer, This Little Light, the name of the show, is a one-woman piece done in drama and song. And it tells the story of Fannie Lou Hamer, her life as a Mississippi sharecropping woman, and rising above that to making a decision to go and register to vote. And, of course, from there she was catapulted into the civil rights movement, and she worked for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She was every organizer's dream. She was somebody who heard the message and decided to get up and do something about it, since it was the right message. It was.
Before we go further, do you find that people are unfamiliar with Fannie Lou Hamer, who she was, and her impact on the civil rights movement?
They don't know nearly as much about Ms. Hamer as they should, and not nearly as many people know about her as they should, particularly the generation that came after, came of age after the civil rights movement. And I'm finding that to be true in schools and colleges, but also among middle-aged people. I'm finding people who have not heard of Mrs. Hamer. In spite of the fact that I have been doing this show for 21 years, it has been a stage performance. It hasn't been film. And so, therefore, the number of people who can see it is limited in terms of that being a vehicle to make it, as I envision, her name, a household word.
But I want to go back to the woman, Fannie Lou Hamer. Why did you select her? I mean, what is it about Fannie Lou Hamer that drew you to her?
I was drawn to Ms. Hamer at the time when she became active, but specifically I met her on the day of Hurricane Camille in Mississippi. Mrs. Hamer was in Alabama giving a speech to some farmers, and I was working for those farmers in one of the Great Society programs. And after the conference was over, I went up to ask her, as did several other young people, why did she choose to do this work? And she said, "Baby, I didn't choose. I was chosen." And when I listened to Mrs. Hamer talk, and she talked without fear, without any trepidation, I had never heard anybody speak that way. And I was privileged, after going away and going to law school for in Alabama, she died, and I was not able to attend her funeral. And I was privileged to be able to go and live in Mississippi for several years, many years. And once I did, I realized that a lot of people were losing sight of her. And it had only been 6 years since she had died when I premiered the show. And I just, I felt like, here's a voice. This is the voice of our mothers. This is the voice I grew with. This in a language that I grew up hearing. And I wanted people to grasp the essence of a poor woman, an uneducated woman, but a woman of conviction, of courage, of unparalleled strength in terms of what she could do, both physically and mentally. And she was leading. She was leading, speaking in her own language, on her own terms, and brilliantly so. And I wanted people to know that, because Fannie Lou is us, and she's of us. And that's where we spring from. And I wanted people to know about her.
During the period that she grew up in, talk about that particular period and how much courage it took for any individual, let alone a black woman, to speak against a system that was prevalent there in Mississippi.
Yes, it was prevalent. in Mississippi and the Deep South in general. I recall that era as a time when I worked in the homes of white people after my father died. And if you disagree with what a white person said, they would ask you in all seriousness, are you accusing me of lying? You couldn't disagree with them. And so not only that, though, Fannie Lou had many things from which to suffer. She lost a place to live when she decided to go register to vote. She worked on a Mississippi Delta plantation. It was hard to get off the plantation. People were usually embroiled in debt because the landowner furnished the land and people furnished the labor and gathered the crop. And then were told at the end of that they probably just broke even or almost got out of debt because people had to also take up food and those kinds of things, the seeds and all of that. So it also meant that your livelihood was entangled with people such that you could lose your job. You could lose the right to do things that you had taken as a matter of course, like credit, like having credit. And that happened to Ms. Hamer, actually, when she came back from trying to register to vote in Indianola, Mississippi. She was asked to leave.
I'm interested also, here was this courageous black woman. She was fighting against racism, no doubt sexism, the brutality of the period. So it was doubly difficult, I would think, on Mrs. Hamer in terms of trying not just to vote, but just trying to exist in a male-dominated racist society.
Of course. It was male chauvinism was the thing of the day. It is the way people thought things should be. Women were not allowed to speak up. I'm sure Pap Hamer was told to sit that woman down, not just by white people, but by black people as well. And certainly when Fannie Lou Hamer spoke at the Democratic National Convention in 1964, there were people there in her group who did not want her to speak and would not have chosen her as the person to speak. Yet she speaks... She spoke so eloquently that the president of the United States was moved to get her off TV. He called a press conference and took away the cameras away from her. But she spoke so eloquently that the press chose to play her speech twice the next day in full, not just a snippet, as might have been done.
Could you give us a snippet of Fannie Lou Hamer in her own words as articulated by you?
Sure. From the fourth chapter of St. Luke, beginning at the 18th verse, the Spirit of the Lord is upon us, for he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and the recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bound, and to preach the acceptable year of our Lord. Now the time have come that was Christ's purpose on earth. We only been getting by paying our way to hell. That was Miss Hamer, one of her, what we call her mass meeting speech. But equally, she spoke less conciliatory, in speaking just in general, there's a passage in which she questions this very United States. I question America. I used to say when I was working so hard in the cotton field, if I could just get to Washington, get to the Congress, to the Justice Department, to the FBI, get close up, nuss up on them to let them know what was going on in Mississippi, I was sure I could get things changed in just 1 week. Now that I have traveled across America, been to the Congress, to the Justice Department and to the FBI. I'm faced with some things I ain't too sure I wanted to find out. This your sickness in Mississippi ain't no Mississippi sickness. This is America's sickness. You know, Miss Hamer had a way with the English language that gave us pause. You had to stop when you heard her speak. And she grew in eloquence as time went on. And that is portrayed in the performance that I do on her. From just being a woman who wanted to sit down and talk to her husband one night about wanting to go register to vote, to a person of philosophy. She not only understood the black struggle, she understood all struggles. She went to the women's movement. She went to the environmentalists. She worked with the welfare rights mothers. She saw that if you help the least of these, that you help the whole culture.
That was excellent, excellent, very beautiful, very powerful as well.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, how does Billie Jean Young get into or got into the head of Fannie Lou Hamer? How do you transpose yourself from Billie Jean Young to Fannie Lou Hamer? What's the process?
Well, much of what Miss Hamer was about has a lot to do with the universality of the human experience. All of us have experienced pain and suffering, disappointment. All of us want better for our families, our communities, our children. As an artist and as the researcher and the writer for Fannie Lou Hamer, This Little Light, I had to first decide who and what she was about, and write a play that would give us her essence. I didn't make up anything about Miss Hamer. Most of the times I use her own words, except when the storyteller tells part of the story. But basically, we're talking about her own words, and having interviewed her friends, I got a lot of her personality, and a lot of her the kind of person she was absent the civil rights movement. And so I spend time, as what we call as artists, getting into character. I spend some time in meditation. I spend as much time as I can with Miss Hamer. That is reviewing my text, reviewing her writings and her work, her speeches, and that kind of thing. And I'll tell you, the best preparation I think I had was when I went to do the second performance, and her family gave me her room. And I went into her room, which was still populated with a lot of her things, and there was a picture of her on the wall. And I sat underneath that picture, and I found myself praying, Lord, don't let me make a fool out of myself in Miss Hamer's hometown. I knew with all of the lack of trepidation that I had as a very young person, I knew once I was there that I was in her hometown. And I couldn't fudge it, and this was somebody people knew and remembered well. This ordinary woman, who was so extraordinary in her living, her legacy is one of activism. It is one of that says, be not afraid.
On this edition of Like It Is, we're speaking with the Honorable Larry Gossett, one of Seattle's Gang of Four. 50 years after the founding of this legendary group, it's still known as a model of interracial organizing. Thanks for being here.
First of all, thank you very much, Denny. It's always a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to talk to you. But the Gang of Four, we did not see ourselves as a special type of men. We saw ourselves as everyday people, and we had the unique opportunity together because individually we saw, wow, wouldn't it be nice if Black and Latino and Asian and Native American people could figure out a way to, you know, work together and create more energy and power and political influence. And the Four Amigos are folks that had a lot to do with bringing people together, as well as a lot of progressive white Democrats and others, and white religious leaders helped us to build a political agenda. This is around the time that Martin Luther King was assassinated. 5 days before that, was the first time I ever met Roberto Maestas. At that time, Roberto Maestas was the main Spanish teacher at a high school up in Seattle called Franklin High School. Students had been empowered a few months before March by organizing the second high school Black student union in Seattle. Garfield High School was the first. And the reason they organized is because of all the systematic racism being faced by Black students at Franklin. It had 1,800 students, 175 of whom were Black at that time. And every Black male that had had a fight with a white male at Franklin High School had been suspended or expelled. Every white kid that had a fight with these Black male students at Franklin had been sent back to class and said, don't stop all that foolishness. March 29, 1968, two Black girls were actually kicked out of Franklin High School for, of all things, wearing their hair natural. They sent a note home signed by the principal, and the note said, your daughter can no longer attend Franklin High School until she looks ladylike. That's how bad white racism was at that time. And that was so outrageous to the Black student that they called me. I was a Black student union leader at the University of Washington at that time. I had graduated from Franklin. And they said, we're getting ready to burn down the building because we're so angry about the racism down here. And we said, no, just try to get the students together across the street from Franklin and we'll come down there and help y'all organize, figure out something. We didn't want them burning up school because we knew that we'd get all our brothers and sisters in jail. So we zoomed down there in our automobile, took about 12 minutes. And even driving down there, we saw dozens and dozens of police cars. So we went around the corner and up the street to Franklin and organized the students. And they decided, with our recommendations, to instead organize the first sit-in in the history of Seattle that was led by Black youth. They came together and quickly came up with some demands. That ended up being successful. And from that day forward, Roberto and I stayed friends. The third member of the Gang of Four was Bernie White Bear. And in 1969, I got a call from Bernie White Bear, and Roberto got a call from Bernie White Bear, saying that the natives are down at Frank's Landing, and they were fishing on what is up here called the Puyallup River. And their tribe, Puyallups and the Muckleshoots and others, had signed a treaty with the European government that existed here in 1855. And they signed a treaty that said for as long as the rivers flowed, that they would be able to exercise as indigenous people, they would be able to exercise the right to fish. No hindrance whatsoever. And now the Washington State Fisheries was telling them you only can catch 30% of the fish. And me and about 10 other Black student union members and about 20 members of the Black Panther Party went out and expressed solidarity with the natives. Bernie White Bear was, even though he called us, we had not met him until we got to that state and we met he and other leaders of indigenous people. and we expressed solidarity with the fishing rights struggle. So that's how we met Bernie. Finally, the fourth member of the Gang of Four was Bob Santos. He was Catholic. He was Filipino. He was head of a Catholic Community Service Center called Caritas House, located in Seattle's historic Black community, the central area. And he became the only person willing to allow a Black revolutionary, Black power groups to meet at his facility. Bob allowed Roberto Massas and Larry Gossett and the Black Student Union and the Black Panther Party to have somewhere to meet, and we were highly appreciative.
You're listening to Like It Is. I'm Denny Luna, and we're speaking with Larry Gossett of Seattle's Gang of Four.
And we met Bob Santos in 68 or 69. We didn't always have enough money to pay the rent, and he was cool. He just said, well, the Lord will find a way. And, you know, we never had problems meeting. A year or two after that, he became the leader of an organization in the International District Chinatown called the International Improvement Association, a social service organization that served poor in the historic Asian community down there, 72. Roberto had founded, with all of our support, El Centro de la Raza, which means in Spanish, the Center for All Peoples. Roberto was the head of that by 72. Bernie Whitebear, meanwhile, had led a group of natives who had reclaimed land that had also been promised to him, them in the 1850s. We built a very powerful political force, and this movement stayed together until well into the 21st century. 2017 was when Bob Santos died, became the third member of the Gang of Four to pass away. So for 40 years, we've built tremendous unity across racial lines, that, for instance, in terms of securing government funds for housing and social services for youth organizations, start getting up to millions of dollars. Thank you for allowing me the time to share that.
Well, absolutely. And I'm going to remind our listeners that you're listening to Like It Is. And we're speaking with Larry Gossett, who was the part of the Gang of Four or the Four Amigos. I didn't realize until you brought this up just now that El Centro de la Raza meant Center for All People.
Yeah, that's what it means, literally.
Yeah. And then I just read last night that Daybreak Star with United Indians of All Tribes was actually named for a poem that Black Elk, where he described the four races coming together and forming a Daybreak Star.
Yeah, we the Four Amigos were honored a lot out at Daybreak Star, different ceremonies.
Were you aware that there were these movements to kind of divide you all and to play each other against each other? And I think I'd read where one of the reasons that you got what you all did in terms of occupying buildings and getting the land and the buildings for each of your organizations, and the reason that happened is because you were all four together. And then the city officials or whoever needed to approve those projects, they kind of were stymied because they weren't able to say, oh, well, we can't do that for you now. We got to look at these other groups that bring
yes. Yeah, Bernie organized all the natives in this region, the Muckleshoots, the Puyallup, everybody, and worked together. And we saw that we could make a difference. And we built unity. And when there was conflict, we sat at the table and ironed them out.
Yeah, and there could be a lot of intergroup conflict between and among the different groups.
And there were some differences on political direction, political philosophy. You know, that occur, some kind of just personal jealousy, that, but we worked them out for the most part. There were Trump-like figures that existed in the Pacific Northwest before Donald Trump. There were conservative politicians that tried to resist Bob Santos getting money in the international just to build low-income housing. They say, we don't want all the low-income people to stay. stay there. But by all of us coming together, they weren't able to call the Mexicans and blacks like they used to do in the 60s and early 70s and say, oh, the Indians want this. We got to give it to them now. We don't really want to, but we got to do it. Sorry, we can't do anything for you. We were able to put kibunches and stops to all that nonsense oftentimes, not every time, because we had built a presence of us working together across racial lines. Another person that was very involved in this was Tyree Scott from the United Construction Workers Association, who built a massive unity amongst national minority people to support the right of blacks to be integrated into the construction industry as apprentices and not allowing the politicians or foundations to divide us one from another. And we built a very successful unity. And we wrote a book about the Gang of Four that has sold thousands of copies all over the region and the world. Australia, Nicaragua, a lot of political leaders in those countries that read our book and called us. Japanese activists called us. India, the Untouchables called us to talk to them. It's been quite a work in terms of the Gang of Four.
And the other thing I guess I wanted to impart to people was that you were real human and you were very welcoming and you were very joyful in the work that you did. There's this phrase, joy is a form of resistance.
Yeah, I understand what that means.
You were celebrating people just coming together and in crazy little skits that you guys.
Four of us dancing and the takeoff of Gladys Knight and the Pips. It was very, very popular. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, you made it welcoming, you know, to go between any of the groups in the city. There was just that feeling that you belonged. And you know, not only minorities, but people of all different
people. Yeah, whites. Yeah, all different people.
So I guess just congratulations. You were talking about getting the county, Martin Luther King Jr.
County. Yeah, we got that done in 2005. Seattle is located in the only geographic space in the world community that has formally adopted the name of Martin Luther King Jr. So this is Martin Luther King Jr. County, Seattle, and 38 cities, other cities like, you know, Renton and Federal Way are all located within the boundaries of Martin Luther King Jr. County. And believe me, that wouldn't have been done if we couldn't keep minorities and all the progressive whites throughout the county supporting the effort. It took us 6 years because we had to change state law in order to change in this county name to honor Dr. King.
Well, on that note, we're going to end this. I want to thank you again.
All right.
We've been talking with Honorable Larry Gossett.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.